Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I'm pretty excited. We have a very special guest here today. Lisa Moore is a canine behavior counselor, and Lisa is joining us to talk about dealing with aggression in our dogs, whether it's our own personal dogs or dogs that we've bred, God forbid, or dogs that we see in the neighborhood. So Lisa, thank you so much for joining us and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yay. So you are the owner of Top Notch Kennel and several of those facilities in Central California, and you do a lot of work specifically with aggressive dogs, correct?
That's correct. That's my specialty.
Okay. So give us the 411. How did you wind up here, right? What brought right? you to this particular specialty?
Well, I got my first purebred dog, a Sheltie, when I was 18. And started training primarily in obedience at that time. And I got hooked in the sport pretty quickly and did a lot of competitive obedience showing for many years. I'm what you call a crossover trainer, meaning I started like many did back when I started, which was some 33 years ago. I started with corrective work. I had happy working dogs. I couldn't win national tournaments if I didn't have a precise but happy working dog. But it was only about 12 years ago that I crossed over and started getting educated in the science of dog training and became a clicker trainer and got my certification through Karen Pryor Academy as a certified professional trainer using the science of learning and clickers primarily.
Excellent. And that is, people talk a lot about positive training or correction training and all of that sort of thing. And you're working very specifically with positive reinforcement and counter conditioning.
Correct. Correct. Basically, being a certified professional trainer through KPA means that I am a positive reinforcement only trainer. And I was kind of brought to that side of training about 12 years ago when one of my Treviren, I've been in Belgian Treviren for over 30 years, one of my Treviren had aggression issues, had pretty big aggression issues. Mm. And the old techniques that I had for basically correcting that dog into submission were not going to be effective with this dog, not without somebody, primarily me, getting hurt. Wow. So I sought another way. And that was my primary motivation for starting down this path. And I was thrilled with not only the results that I attained with my own dog, but just learned so much more about dog training in general. And every area of training that I've been interested in that I've applied this to has just improved dramatically. So I'm really, really happy that I'm one of those crossover trainers and have made the switch.
Excellent. So give us a little bit of an idea, because I think this is something that a lot of sort of people in the general public and even really a lot of us in the fancy don't necessarily understand what CPDTXYZ, just, you know, some of that alphabet soup. Give us a little bit of understanding about that.
Well, the problem with dog training as a profession is it is at this point still an unregulated profession. Which essentially means anybody can hang up a shingle and call themselves a dog trainer.
Right.
There are plenty of places that you can get 8 weeks of training, either online or otherwise, and call yourself a professional. So that's a little scary. There are, thankfully, some good organizations for educational purposes. The ones that are most important to me are the credentials that I keep current. One of those is I'm a Karen Pryor Academy alumni. So I have my certification through KPA as a certified professional trainer. And the Karen Pryor Academy is probably the most recognized academy that focuses solely on positive reinforcement style training and clicker training specifically. Mm-hmm. Another certification that I have is through the Association of Pet Dog Trainers, or APDT. So people with those certifications, it would look I think it's CCPDT.
Like I said, it's so the alphabet soup, man.
Right. And those are certainly what I would consider a couple of the better organizations. I'm a big fan of Karen Pryor Academy, so
okay.
That one's really important to me. And I think it's really important in our profession to never think that we know it all. I mean, I am a seminar junkie. I go to lots of them each and every year because I think continued education is key. And it also is required in order to maintain my credentials in those two organizations, which again, I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And so let's talk about whether this is a companion dog, whether it's a mixed breed dog, whether it's a purebred dog. Aggression is aggression is aggression is aggression across the board in the canine world.
Yeah.
So We talked a little bit, and I think the three topics that we settled on, fear aggression, leash reactivity, and resource guarding. So can we kind of take those in order?
Sure. And if I may say, just before we delve into those specifics, there are a couple of general principles to keep in mind when working with aggression in particular, regardless of the type. One is that there is absolutely no room for corrections, meaning that punishing any type of aggressive behavior will ultimately make the problem worse. And I'm happy to expand on that if you'd like.
Yeah, we'll definitely want to carry on with that. So what's number two? And then we'll go back and expand on number one.
Number two would be that there are no quick fixes.
Mm-hmm.
Corrections will definitely suppress the behavior, but that is by no means a fix. And if you're dealing with a dog that has any type of aggression issue or reactivity issue, you're looking at a process that sometimes goes in very small little steps in terms of improvement. And probably the third thing to keep in mind is that management will always play some sort of role when you have a reactive dog. You certainly want to work on modifying behavior, but you'll always have to remember that management will be important as well.
Okay, excellent. So let's go back and focus just for a few minutes on the do not correct the aggression, because for many listeners in this population, as I'm sure you're aware, that is going to fly in the face of all the advice they get from all the internet chat rooms.
Exactly. Right. So gosh, where to begin?
Well, let's talk a little bit about why correcting aggression does not solve it.
Okay. So first of all, there's that term that's thrown around all the time. That aggression just came out of nowhere. He did it for no reason, blah, blah, blah. Dogs will always have a reason for being aggressive. They will always tell you that they're getting ready to be aggressive. In other words, there are plenty of tells that your dogs have that can give you an early warning that there is trouble brewing. Part of the problem with being corrective with an aggressive dog is, for example, you'll see it a lot at dog shows and any place, basically, where people have dogs that are misbehaving. The second their dog growls, they start correcting. They pop on the leash, they scold the dog. And can that be effective? Absolutely. It can shut down the growl after some repetition because, you know, dogs aren't stupid. If they are physically and or verbally corrected for something, of course they're going to stop it. But what that does is makes your job in the long run harder because now your dog's emotional state is harder for you to read. When you start shutting things down like a growl, your dog becomes less predictable. So we as dog trainers or people in my profession that are really into modifying behavior, those telltale signs are really important to us. And if we're astute enough to be able to read the dog properly, things like facial wrinkles, posture, where is the weight shifted, where's the tail set, where's the ear set, those are indicators that come long before the growl that can give us an inkling as to our dog's emotional state so that we can take action before there is an aggressive response.
Right. So a lot of this is about learning how to understand what your dog is telling you in their language and listening to them.
Yeah. Being able to read your dog is a huge factor when you're working with a dog that has some aggressive or reactive tendencies, for sure.
Okay.
If growling is the only thing that you're looking for or waiting for, you're late to the party.
Yeah.
Because that comes in pretty far into the behavior as it's happening.
Okay. Very, very good. So let's talk then in specifics about fear aggression and what you see, how you identify fear aggression, how you work to redirect it or whatever your modification is going to be and move forward from there.
So fear aggression is certainly, in my opinion, and I think that's shared by many others that do the same thing that I do, it's one of the easiest types of aggression to fix. Because if you can get the fear to go away, the aggression goes away right along with it. Fearful dogs will generally choose, you know, there are two options, flight or fight. And oftentimes we see more of an aggressive outburst with frightened dogs when their option for flight is taken away. And that may be because they're contained in a specific area or they're on leash. Both of those things take away their ability to flee from whatever is scary to them. And some people may grasp the idea that their dog is fearful, but mistakenly think that just taking their dog by leash closer to the thing that is fearful will help them to magically get over it. And of course, that's not the case. So when you're talking about a dog that is fearful, your job is to rather methodically through practice and certain exercises, help the dog become more confident and less fearful. And that's done in a very specific way. You're basically doing counter conditioning and desensitization. Those two things work together in this type of process. So it's important to, first of all, expose your dog to whatever they're fearful of. Let's call that the trigger. Maybe you've got a dog that, well, let's just say most commonly is afraid of other dogs.
Right.
So another dog would be the trigger for the dog to become fearful and or reactive. So your job would be to expose your dog to the presence of other dogs, but at a distance where your dog is aware of the presence of the trigger, but is not yet going over threshold. And by going over threshold, I mean is not going to get reactive about it. He sees the other dog, he's aware of it, but he's not going to become reactive. Second thing that's of utmost importance here is to pair whatever the dog is fearful of with something positive. So the thing that is used most frequently because it's the most effective is food. Mm-hmm. Food's the primary reinforcer. And it's not just your regular dog treats that you get at the pet store. This is something that has to compete for your dog's attention. So it needs to be smelly. It needs to be moist. And you need to have a lot of it. So when you've got your trigger set up and you've got plenty of treats available, now you can start to work. What I do most frequently is called LAT, or look at that. In other words, I want my dog to look at the thing that makes him afraid. So this would be the trigger dog. And the instant my dog looks at that trigger, I'm going to mark. And my mark is going to be a click. We can talk about whether it has to be a click down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But my mark is going to be a click. I'm marking the instant that my dog looks at that trigger. And then because my dog is familiar with marker or positive reinforcement training, he understands that that mark or the click equals a food reward. And when I give that food reward, it's done in such a way that the dog's head has now turned away from the trigger. So eye contact is being broken while I deliver that treat. So basically, the click has acknowledged the dog for looking at the trigger. I'm telling my dog, good job for looking at that trigger. Now here's your reward. And as soon as my dog has said the reward, ideally, my dog's head is going to go back and look at that trigger again. And I'm going to keep repeating. So every time he looks at the trigger, I click. I deliver a treat as he looks away, which breaks eye contact with the trigger. Because the longer the dog looks at the trigger, the higher the arousal level tends to go.
Right.
And I'm trying to play with those low arousal levels at this point.
Right.
So I will continue with that process until my dog says, okay, I get it. I'm no longer even remotely interested in that trigger. The next step would be to move slightly closer to that trigger. And you play the same game and it continues. And again, there's lots and lots of repetitions to this.
Right.
But gradually over time, and it's not in the same training session, there are many training sessions, But over time, what you're doing is you're building your dog's tolerance to the triggers. Plus, and this to me is the most important, you're changing the dog's CER, or conditioned emotional response. Right now, or when you start this process, your dog's conditioned emotional response toward that trigger is reactivity in some way, whether that's lunging and barking or hanging back and tucking their tail and shifting their weight back and hiding. There's already an emotional response there when that dog sees the trigger. I'm trying to change that. I want to change that emotional response into something positive and accepting and neutral, for lack of a better word. So that's my goal with that process.
Excellent. And so that is a process, and I think this is important for listeners to understand, that's a process that doesn't happen in 5 minutes. That doesn't even happen in 5 days.
No, it doesn't. And a couple of things I always tell my clients when they're working on this. Number one, if you're doing it correctly, it's about as exciting as watching paint dry, because there are no emotional outbursts from the dog. There is no drama. There is nothing to correct. You're working in these teeny tiny little increments, trying to help the dog to gradually become more tolerant and relax around these triggers. The second thing that I'm always telling them is that, yes, lots of repetition is important, but it's not like you carve out 2 hours of your day because it's the only time that you have all week to work on this. You're far better off doing this in small bites. In other words, 15 to 20 minutes here, 2 or 3 times a day if you have the ability to do that. If not, if it's just once a day, that's fine. But you can't go about this for an hour and a half. It's just too stressful on the dog. It is.
Right.
So you've got to go about it slowly and methodically.
Quick question then, and this is one I've heard or seen or what have you. The dog, you take it, it sees the trigger dog, and it starts lunging and barking. So my guess here is you're not then going to feed it. You're going to back up and try to get to a lower arousal level.
Correct. Yes. Using this process, if your dog's lunging and barking, then he's already over threshold. So no training is really happening at that point, other than your dog is being allowed to practice the exact behavior you're trying to eradicate.
Right.
So there's no correction in the moment. I mean, the behavior's already happened, so a correction isn't going to fix anything. Your very best bet is using one of what I would call a management tool, because management tools go right along with this. You have to be taught what to do when real life throws you a curveball.
Exactly.
So in a situation like that, we would employ probably our emergency U-turn, which is just giving the dog in just a regular tone of voice, even if you have to grit your teeth while you're doing it. Come on, Cujo, come on, let's go this way. And your job is to immediately do a tight U-turn and move off in the opposite direction, creating space between you and that trigger.
Right. Without rewarding it or validating it by your response. Yes?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not clicking and giving cookies to the dog that has gone off at the end of his leash. I may be correcting, but I'll just be correcting myself for being such an idiot at putting my dog into that situation.
Well, you know, sometimes dogs walk by, man. You know, I mean, that's why I wanted to ask that specific question. And I think, too, and speak to this for me, because I think this is something that a lot of people don't think about. Our dogs respond to our body language, right? And
so absolutely.
If we tense up and get stressed out the minute we see that dog crossing our path, how much is that adding to our dog's hijacked arousal level?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, there's that common concept of your emotions feed down the lead to the dog.
Correct.
It's absolutely true. We've seen many, many clients that have literally created a least reactive dog.
Correct.
Which is kind of eye-opening to them when we can take that dog off leash and introduce that dog to other dogs and even have them in play groups. In our daycare, he does just fine. But put him on leash and put that leash in the owner's hands, and it's a whole different story. And that oftentimes is caused by an owner that doesn't really understand their dog or understand dog language in general, that may be afraid of other dogs. And so when other dogs are around, they have unconsciously pulled up on the leash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their breath comes a little shorter. They tighten up. They start talking to their dog. It's okay, Fluffy. It's okay. It's okay. Come on. Let's
right.
Go. And all of that can be greatly misinterpreted by the dog. And the dog says, well, you're concerned. perhaps I should be too.
Ding, so, ding, ding. I tell people that all the time.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, with this type of work, everybody assumes that we're just working on the dog, but that's really not the case. You know, a lot of our work involves reteaching the owner how to fake being calm and how to purposely take a look at your hands and relax the leash and take deep breaths. And if your dog is looking at you, you know, blink and yawn a little bit and try to give off your own calming signals. The nice thing about practicing that too is, as our students do, is, you know, you fake it until you make it.
Yes.
But if you fake it long enough, it does tend to become your new go-to behavior, which is only a big aid to the dog. You know, when they right. look at their person and their person is yawning and totally relaxed, your dog's going to take your body language into consideration. And that's really important.
Thank you. That is exactly what I wanted to hear, because that is what I tell people all the time. So that's good. So we,
yay
me. I feel like I've been validated. No, sorry. Seriously, the leash reactivity was our next topic anyway. So I think if you could continue mm-hmm. on that, and it's so much about our body language, but some of the other things that you see.
Well, leash reactivity is basically when your dog has an inappropriate response to a trigger. And usually leash reactivity is in relation to seeing other dogs. Sometimes it's other people, but we see it most frequently in other dogs. And one of the frustrating things about this is, as I mentioned just a moment ago, about how owners can create it, but there's also a huge issue among pet owners when they're doing the responsible thing and, you know, walking their dogs on leash and in their own neighborhood, doing the legal thing, and they're accosted by a loose dog.
Right.
And we have a number of clients that have reactive dogs simply because of those types of experiences. You know, the loose dog isn't necessarily friendly. The owner panics. Even if the dog on leash isn't hurt, he's often scared. And so, you know, the next time the dog voices his concern about seeing another dog because he wants that other dog to move away before he gets any closer and possibly does get injured. So it's a real common occurrence, especially with our city dogs and how often we encounter dogs off leash that are not under control. So at any rate, what I was mentioning earlier about the look at that,
right.
or the counter conditioning desensitization protocol is basically the same thing. You definitely want to expose your dog to as many triggers as you safely can. And I should also say, this doesn't mean just walking around your neighborhood waiting for a dog to show up, because again, that's real life stuff and you can't
right.
control a lot of those variables.
Right.
A lot of our practice in the beginning is absolutely set up. You know, we use dogs that are neutral dogs on leash with another trainer. We'll use stuffed animal dogs that are anatomically correct and look like a real dog.
All right, crew. I just found out some very cool stuff. I learned that Trupanion has a breeder support program. And Trupanion is medical insurance for dogs and cats also. And I always want to give you guys the coolest new information. So I have here with me Haran Greer, who is the senior account manager at Trupanion. Met her when we were up in Enumclaw at the Olympic Kennel Club show and really had just a cool visit. So I thought you guys would enjoy hearing from her a little bit. So, hey, Haran.
Hey, Laura. Thanks for having me. It really was nice meeting you at the dog show. The Trupanion Breeder Support Program partners with ethical, responsible breeders across the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico to get puppies and kittens covered from day one of joining their forever family. What we do is we create a certificate for each breeder that joins that program, and then the breeder gives that certificate to their buyers. And if they want to take advantage of it, the new owners activate the certificate 24 hours before until 24 hours after taking their new pet home to try us out.
I just think that is so cool. And now, if I do this for my puppy buyers, there's no cost to me. Is that correct?
You're correct. There's no cost to the breeder whatsoever. We create the certificate. We will send you the seasonal starter kits for your take-home folders. Those starter kits include what a new owner can expect in raising a puppy, seasonal advice and hazards, as well as more information on Trupanion. Also, throughout the year, we have fun promotions where we send out puppy blankets so that the puppy can go home with their mom's scent. So essentially, they can go home covered in Trupanion.
Which I just think is totally cool. And you see this, right? Like, you see claims coming through that this is actually working.
Yes, it's not uncommon at all to see claims of broken bones, foreign body ingestion, and other surprises that come with raising a new puppy or kitten. What it ends up being is just simply peace of mind for the breeder and the new owner by ensuring that the owner can give their pet the best care without being tied to financially based decisions when the unexpected occurs.
And I think that is amazing because in our society, everything has a cost. And as breeders, we're able to offer that service to our puppy buyers. That's peace of mind for us. It's peace of mind for them, right?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I take care of my people. So now you guys have heads up on this very cool option. If you want more information on joining the Trupanion Breeder Support Program, check out the show notes. We'll have a link in there. Or you can go directly to trupanion.com/breeder and make sure that you mention you heard it on Pure Dog Talk. And we're back to the podcast. So we were talking about the leash reactivity, and we were talking about ways that you can counter condition that sort of in a incremental fashion.
The time to work on this is when you can create setups. The time to work on it is not when you're at a dog show,
right,
or even just out in your neighborhood when you don't really know what you're going to encounter. You know, it has to be set up specifically with a trigger at an appropriate distance so that you know where your dog is to focus. And that's one of the reasons why so many people with reactive dogs choose to have them trained professionally for a while,
mm-hmm,
because of the time involved and because of the setups that have to be made. And as a trainer, it's something that I prefer. I can go in and make a much bigger difference with a dog a whole lot faster than I can when I'm taking an owner from the ground up.
Right.
It's much easier to pass that dog off to an owner and show them how to maintain and continue to go once the dog already has had a lot of this repetition under their belt.
Yeah.
But at any rate, it's something that, you know, you do it very gradually. And again, it's like watching paint dry if you're doing it properly. I should also say that going back a moment to the fearful dog, what we didn't touch on is if we have a dog that's just fearful of not necessarily being aggressive yet, but fearful in general, whether it's the garbage can or a judge going over the dog for an examination. You know, when you see a dog that's fearful of that, it's great that the dog is not aggressive, but if you don't address that early on, it can certainly lead to aggression. Because when a dog is showing signs of fearfulness and nobody is, quote, listening to him, oftentimes as they grow and mature, they start using different tactics to get that whatever is causing them fear to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to not ignore those little signs of fearfulness, but rather to help your dog gain confidence early on so that there is no need for the dog down the road to start using his growl and his mouth to start dictating who can touch them and where.
Right. Absolutely. And that's kind of a good segue, I think, for the resource guarding topic, because that is another one of those things. I'm telling you, I'm the dog telling you, no, you can't have this for X reason.
Right. Yeah. And resource guarding is, it's a normal behavior. Those of us that live with dogs in our home, we would certainly consider it an inappropriate behavior, but it shouldn't be looked upon as an abnormal behavior because it's not. It's extremely normal. I mean, people are protective of their resources as well. You know, things that are important to us, we're protective over. That's just kind of the way it goes. However, it does make for a dog that can be dangerous or not suitable to be around children if they've got some resource guarding issues. And I think the most common one that people think of when they hear that term is guarding food resources, food,
right,
bones, that kind of thing. But resource guarding can be over just about anything. You know, a dog that is considered protective is usually resource guarding his property,
mm-hmm,
or resource guarding his person. You know, there's resource guarding of furniture and toys and all kinds of things.
Right. Attention.
Yeah, exactly. Attention. But by and large, food and high in value treats and chews and things is the most common type of resource guarding that we see. So to prevent it as well as to treat it is, it's a similar process. First of all, part of the way that this is created is our false idea that every dog in our household needs to learn that we own everything and we can take anything away that we want to from a dog at any time and there should be no argument about it. And we see that type of mentality and that type of practice cause resource guarding issues all the time. A better approach is to let your dog know from the beginning that anytime he has something of value and you approach, it's going to equal something better for the dog. So if you can imagine what a dog's behavior looks like when he's got his favorite bone and he's guarding it a little bit, that could show itself as freezing over the item and maybe just staring at you while the head is lowered. It might mean putting a paw over the item or around the item. It could be the dog picking up the item and trying to move away. It could be a low growl. All of those things indicate that your dog is saying, this is valuable to me and I don't want to have to fight you for it. But if we can go in with the idea of every time you're chewing on something and I walk by, I'm going to give you something that you like even more and not try to take your item. What we're doing there is we're, again, going back to the conditioned emotional response. We're changing the dog's response to our approach. I want the dog, instead of feeling like, uh-oh, there could be a potential fight over my precious item here, I want the dog to go, oh, joy, here she comes. What's she got for me now?
Right.
And when this is working properly, you can see the dog will stop chewing on the item and he'll look at you, not with a hard eye stare, but he'll usually let go of the item. He'll look up at you, ears are cocked, and maybe there's a tail wag. You drop a couple of extra treats and you walk by again. And you repeat that process many times. I want my dog to drop his bone, take my treats from my hand if we're comfortable doing that, and then I walk away. And when it comes time for me to need to take that item away from the dog, I'm going to trade every single time. So that means I bring an item of higher value, something smelly, something soft, steak, chicken, mozzarella cheese, what have you, and I'm going to present that to the dog and let the dog make the decision. I might take a few of those choice pieces of goodies and toss them a foot or so away from the dog. And if he decides that what I've offered is better than what he's currently chewing on, he's going to drop his chewy and move over to pick up those goodies so that I can pick up whatever I've given him, that chewy, and take it away. So it's done without conflict. So if I do that all the time with my puppies and my juveniles and adult dogs, then there's no history of squabbling over a resource. I'm just looked upon as the one that gives all of this good stuff and occasionally comes by with even better stuff. Who would want to get defensive over that?
Right. Vending machine mom is coming down the hallway.
Exactly. And I will say it works just a little bit different if we already have a long-standing resource guarder. I mean, right. Some dogs, by the time we get to them, are downright dangerous in their behavior. And I would always suggest that if that is the case, that you get a professional involved, just so that safety measures can be taken. It's essentially the same way to address it, but you have to take additional safety precautions to make sure that, you know, especially the owner, who may not understand all of what's in play, doesn't get chewed on or bit during the process of rehabbing that dog.
Right.
But it's a totally solvable behavior, completely
okay.
Solvable.
And that is a perfect segue for our closing conversation, which, as we discussed going in, is one that is fraught with emotion, and understandably so. Are there dogs who are not salvageable, in your opinion?
That's a loaded question. And there are very specific camps on both sides of that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see both sides from the standpoint of most of us, if not all of us, hopefully it's all of us. You know, the one thing that we have in common, even if we disagree on how to achieve results or how to train dogs, we all love dogs.
Right.
And it's a pretty sad thing to see a dog that is so ruined, whether it be by unscrutable breeding practices, you know, whether it's genetics or environmental. It's awfully hard to see a dog that is beyond repair. But I think the reality is that there are some dogs that become too dangerous to really have much of a quality of life, particularly in the hands of a pet owner. I work with a lot of really aggressive dogs, and I can make a lot of headway with them, but I'm very upfront with every owner that I work with in telling them that there will always be management. There will always need to be extra precautions taken. If you want this dog to be reintegrated into your home, regardless of what type of home that is, we find that quite often pet people are unprepared for that type of long-term commitment. And if they're unwilling or unable to properly manage the dog, then yes, that dog can become a general danger, and that's not safe for anybody. At the same time, if we save every dog, what does that mean in terms of quality of life? If we have a dog that really isn't safe to be around anybody, and that dog lives in a run and doesn't get much in the way of stimulation of any kind, is that the way to go? I tend to look at sometimes quality of life versus quantity when having to make those hard decisions. And I guess I do fall on the side of that not every dog is fixable. Not every dog can safely live to a ripe old age when they've got severe issues that can be dangerous.
Right. Okay, well, thank you, Lisa. I would love it if you will provide us with some links that we will make available to the listeners so that they can get more information on all of these topics. And I really, really appreciate your time.
Sure. My pleasure. Happy to.
All right, listeners, we are back with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Laura. How's it going?
Excellent. And today we are talking about mentorship, a hugely important thing here on Pure Dog Talk. We love it.
Yeah, I mean, none of us would really be where we are today without the fantastic mentors that we had. So I do think it's a very important subject.
Fact.
So one of the things that was brought to my attention was I've had quite a few of my students from Leading Edge that don't live near me that are using me as a mentor, say like they're trying to find a local mentor in their area, mm-hmm. and they're just having a really, really difficult time doing it. And a lot of people think that it's them, right? Like they think that it's something that they're doing wrong. So what I want to talk about is if you're out there and, you know, you're trying to do everything right and you are looking for a mentor and you're having a really hard time finding one, it's not you. It's more where our dog shows are at the moment, right? So before we would have these huge entries and these huge dog shows, and there would be like 60 or 80 Irish setters or Afghan hounds or standard poodles at every single dog show. And, you know, with that comes breeders that are coming to watch their breeding stock, and they're hanging around and they're talking to their puppy people. And so even if you're not one of their puppy people, you could stand there and listen, and they would be more than happy to talk to you while they're watching a class of 8, 9 to 12 bitches.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen anymore unless you're at a national specialty or unless you're at one of the bigger dog shows that we have around North America. But for the rest of the dog shows, the entries are so small that even if those breeders don't go, they're standing at ringside now for 15 minutes, not for 2.5 hours.
Right.
So it's harder to find these people. And I think that you still have to put yourself out there. But I think gone are the days where we just had like all this wealth of knowledge around our rings all the time at every dog show. We still have it. We're still lucky. And those people are still out there willing to share their knowledge and be a mentor. But I just think it's the climate of dog shows that we're in right now that makes it harder to recognize those people and also harder for those people to reach out, right? Like when they're at a dog show and they don't have anybody noticing their 9 to 12 puppy bitch because it was the only one in the ring and it just went around the ring and had its bite checked and then left, you know, nobody has time to even admire those dogs anymore.
Right. I think that's so valid, Allison. I really, really do. And I think that it is part of the reason for why people listen to Pure Dog Talk or go and sign up for a Leading Edge Academy for a course, go to Lee Whittier's Dog Show Mentor, you know, all of these places that are sort of coming up like mushrooms. We're all kind of saying, wait, there's this hole, this vacancy that needs to be filled. And I think that's so valuable.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I do have a lot of students turning to me coming from Pure Dog Talk, etc., and saying like, you know, we use these as basically our mentors in our pocket kind of mm-hmm. thing, right?
Yep.
And I mean, that's great to hear. And I'm glad that we are here to help fill the void. But it's not because people don't want to mentor. It's just the opportunities just aren't there the way they used to be.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think so. Two things, my suggestion to mentors, right? Like dog people of our vintage-ish, who have knowledge to share, reach out to somebody that you see standing around kind of gawking at the ring. It might take a little while, but do it. And to the mentees, right, the gawkers, walk up to that person and say, hi, my name is such and such, and I love this 9 to 12 month old puppy bitch. Start the conversation.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that's what we need to do, is we need to recognize that the people are there, you're right, on both sides of the fence. And we need to just make it okay for everybody to talk about it.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Allison, thank you so much. Listeners, please remember Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. Your checkout code is PureDogTalk25. And that will get you 25% off your individual course or your subscription, however you choose to absorb the wisdom of the Allison.
Thanks so much, Laura.
Thanks, Allison. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.